I'm J.G. Michael, and this is Parallax Views.
Parallax is you observe an object, you see a change, but that change is not really a change in the object, but just a change in how you relate to the object in your perspective of the object.
Welcome to the testing room of the Parallax Corporation's Division of Human Engineering.
Now please cross the chair. And you will sit down. Make yourself comfortable. And be sure to place each one of your hands on the box on either side of the chair. Making sure that each one of your fingers is on one of the white rectangles. Just sit back. Nothing is required of you except to observe the materials that are presented to you. Be sure to keep your fingers on the box at all times. Alright? Hope you find the test a pleasant experience.
On this edition of Parallax Views, I'll be speaking with filmmaker Rolf Kanefsky. Rolf has been a mainstay of the horror movie scene since 1991 when he debuted his pre-scream meta-horror comedy, There's Nothing Out There. Some of his other filmmaking credits include 1993's My Family Treasure, starring Dee Wallace, 2004's The Hazing, starring Brad Dourif, Tiffany Shepis, and Perry Shen. 2004's Corpses, starring Jeff Fahey. 2005's Jacqueline Hyde. The American Pie-style comedies, Pretty Cool and Pretty Cool 2. 2006's The Nightmare Man. And more recently, 2017's The Black Room, starring Natasha Henstridge. His latest film, Bus Party to Hell, featuring Tara Reid, will be making its Blu-ray debut on June the 12th. In our discussion, we talk about how Rolf became involved in the horror movie genre, his love of blending horror and comedy, his debut feature, There's Nothing Out There, The Hazing, working with Scream Queen Tiffany Shepis, Bus Party to Hell, an upcoming vampire flick he guest directed for called Sunset Society, and his most recently completed project, Art of the Dead. I hope you enjoy my interview with Rolf Kanefsky. Welcome to the Parallax Views podcast, Rolf Kanefsky.
Hello.
So, how did you get into this, like, wild world of horror films?
How did I get into it? Basically, as I said, I sort of fell in love with Abney Costello movies when I was very young. My father introduced them to me growing up in New York. And the first one I saw was the end of Abney Costello Meet Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde. So that combination of horror and humor stayed with me. And when I saw Abney Costello Meet Frankenstein, obviously that one was still considered one of the best blends of the genre. But horror films scared me a lot growing up, so I had really bad nightmares. So I sort of had a love-hate relationship with them, and it wasn't really until I turned like 13, 14 when I got a video camera and I knew at that point I wanted to be a director that I realized and I started researching that most first-time directors started with horror films, from Spielberg to Coppola to Oliver Stone to, you know, all the, you know, the Discovery and Sam Raimi and everybody. So I started renting every horror film on video to say, okay, if I'm going to do a horror film as my first movie feature, I want to know, you know, the genre inside and out, and that's what basically led to There's Nothing Out There, my first feature film.
And your father was a film editor on a few horror films, wasn't he?
Yes, he was. He was mostly known for documentaries. He was very big into the National Geographic series and and all those things. But he did do some independent films, and some of the famous and infamous titles he worked on was a famous sort of black vampire film called Ganja and Hess, which actually just opened up theatrically again in Kino Lorba, just released it theatrically in one theater in New York City for a week. It's playing now. And he edited that. Spike Lee remade the film a couple of years ago. And then he also worked for Joel M. Reed on some of his horror films, including Bloodsucking Freaks and Bloodbath Anthology and things like that. And then over the years, besides working on my films, he was the post-supervising editor on Just Before Dawn, the Jeff Lieberman movie. So, yeah, he has an interesting resume of both documentaries and genre horror films.
So there's Nothing Out There is a very interesting film. It was your debut from 1991. It's about these 7 teenagers that go to, like, a cabin in the woods. They're menaced by an alien monster, and one of them is a horror movie buff, and he figures out how to stay alive by playing by the rules of a horror film. So how did you get the idea for this sort of horror comedy, this meta-horror comedy?
Well, I was in high school at the time, and I'd seen, I think it was a little before that, there were the two famous reviewers, Gene Siskel and Roger Ebert, had that show At the Movies. And there was a famous episode where they basically talked about all the slasher films and how horrible they were after Halloween, and sort of trashed the whole genre. So I was in spring break. I had a little bit of time, and I was just curious, and I wondered how long it would actually take to write a low-budget exploitation horror film. So I sat down and started writing There's Nothing Out There. I decided by page 5, I had to stop to decide if I wanted to be a slasher movie or a creature film. And I went with a creature because I thought you could do more with a creature than just a guy with a knife. But as I started writing it, I had seen so many horror films at that point, because I started watching them when I was 14, that I just couldn't do the same cliches that I had seen all the time, like dropping the knife and standing in front of an open window and going splitting up and going to the basement alone and skinny dipping. So I said, you know, why hasn't someone in a horror film ever watched a horror film? And especially, it's all teenagers who watch horror films. I'm like, why have they never seen a horror film and know what you shouldn't do? So I thought it'd be fun to have a character who I introduced called Mike, who was kind of me, who was a horror film buff who could basically comment on all those cliches and stupidity that people do in horror films. And at that point, I was already a horror fan because I was going to, like, the Fangoria conventions and all these things. But so I didn't want to really make fun of the genre. I just wanted to make fun of the lazy filmmaking, I thought. Like, well, why does it always have to be a cat? Why is it always a cat that jumps out of a closet or falls from the ceiling? Or, you know, it's just like, come on, come up with something better than that. So I decided I wanted to poke fun at all those conventions and cliches so people would, you know, end it and come up with more intelligent things, you know, to make a scary, fun movie. And that was kind of the inspiration of There's Nothing Out There. And I wrote the script pretty quickly and put it aside. A few friends read it, didn't think much of it. And when I was in college and I started looking through the scripts I had, I'd written about 6 or 7 scripts by then. That one seemed to be the most affordable, since it was 7 people, 1 location, an alien creature that we could make. And I was ready to do a feature. And luckily my parents supported me and helped finance the movie. And that's how we were finally able, in the summer of 1989, when I was 20, to make There's Nothing Out There.
Yeah, and what I like about it is it's the only other film I can think of other than Popcorn from 1991 that sort of has that meta comedy vibe, or a meta vibe on the horror films. It predates Scream by, I think, 5 years, and then it's also, you know, a predecessor of sorts to Cabin in the Woods that Joss Whedon did. I think it's a really special film.
Thanks. Yeah, there hadn't been that many. There was actually a film that I discovered actually after I made There's Nothing Out There called Evil Laugh that had elements of meta stuff. And, of course, if you go back to the 40s, and, there was, you know, between Abbott and Costello horror comedies, and Jerry Lewis and Dean Martin did one called Scared Stiff, and Bob Hope with Ghostbusters, you know, his version, which poked fun at the genre. And you go back to the old Dark House way back when. I mean, there was humor, a lot of times in things where it was different. Well, Mel Brooks' Young Frankenstein, of course. When I did it, I had not really seen someone who had been in a horror film talking about horror films. So to me, that was sort of fresh and new, and that's what kind of saved the film, because right after we shot the film was when the whole genre kind of collapsed for a couple of years, and horror films just sort of died out until Scream brought it back, but nothing out there. The audiences and even the reviewers surprisingly really took to the movie when we started showing it. We just couldn't convince the studios or the agencies really to pay attention to it because it was such a low budget film that they didn't quite understand it. They were like, and this is, I've heard many times, was it's too scary to be funny. It's too funny to be scary. So they didn't quite get it. And I heard for 10 years, that's exactly what John Landis heard when he was pitching the American Wealth in London script around town. They said the exact same thing. Is it a horror film or is it a comedy? Like, yeah, it's both. Well, you can't be both. It's like, well, yes, you can. And of course, Fright Night was a major inspiration. The original, which I thought was a wonderful horror vampire film, while also on the, cliches and having a TV personality, Roddy McDowall be a vampire, the hunter of the vampire. So there have been people who had touched upon ideas like this before.
And one thing I noticed that pervades a lot of your films, I don't know if it was an influence per se, but I feel like there's this punk rock style and sort of DIY aesthetic to it. Were you influenced at all by punk rock or?
Not really, no. The music, I wanted just sort of a fun attitude. I mean, the skinny dipping punks who show up and are in the wrong horror movie and there's nothing out there. They're going to the camp by the lake versus the house by the pond. That I thought was kind of fun to just have that kind of attitude. But we just got kind of a cool music vibe in there, and it wasn't really my scene. I grew up on Broadway and show tunes and soundtracks. Jerry Goldsmith and John Williams and all that kind of stuff. But the offbeat sensibilities, I guess, is what people have taken to that has a sort of punk rock feel, I guess.
Yeah, and you ended up returning again to the horror genre after a few other features in 2004 with Dead Scared, which is also known as The Hazing. Could you tell us about that film?
Sure. It was always The Hazing. Dead Scared was the international title given afterwards because they don't have hazings in Europe, so they didn't know what that meant. The Hazing started a couple of many years before it actually got made. I was working, didn't really work with him, but I sort of was dealing with a producer named Joe Wolf for a short period of time. And Joe Wolf was a producer on the original Halloween and the original Nightmare on Elm Street, as well as Hell Night. And obviously they had made a fair amount of sequels to Halloween and Elm Street, but they had never done a sequel to Hell Night. And I sort of pitched him. I said, well, what about doing a Hell Night 2? So my original thing was Hell Night 2, The Hazing. And that was kind of picking up on some of the vibes of Hell Night, as you can see in The Hazing, with them trying to scare the kids and that whole thing. The film never happened with him. So eventually I'm like, well, you can just do a movie called The Hazing and just, not have any connection to Hell Night. So I wrote a script separately called The Hazing. And for years, the script almost got made. I was dealing with a French producer at the time, Alain Sawitsky, who had produced a lot of the late night cable stuff and the Emmanuel movies and things. And I'd worked on some of those. And I kept convincing, trying to talk him into doing a horror film. And I almost got him to do it because I did. He was doing a series called Sex Files, sort of an erotic Twilight Zone X-File parody. And I said, I pulled the old Roger Corman thing on him, saying, well, how about we do one sort of sexy horror film build this haunted house set and then shoot two movies on it at the same time. And one can be a straight horror film, or horror comedy, The Hazing, and the other one could be part of the Sex Files series. And he basically agreed to that. So we built a really nice set, and we actually shot some, 35 millimeter footage of Halloween around California, LA, because I knew I needed the parades and stuff. But he couldn't raise the money because this was before Scream had come out, and the horror genre had still not taken off, and nobody was really, internationally, pre-sales weren't taking to it. So he made the other film, he made the sexy film, but he never made the horror film. And then years went by, and I almost made it, and then he finally introduced me to another producer, first-time producer named Tom Seedman, who was trying to make a movie himself, sort of a sci-fi movie, and told him that he was going to be making this film, and Tom read the script, liked it, and came on board as a producer, and then Sarisky kind of bowed out and let Tom run with it, and Tom eventually raised the money through his connections, and we finally got to make the movie in 2003, and I got to work with Tiffany Shepis, you know, who had actually been trying to raise money for a couple of years on the film, too, because she had read it when she had a little distribution company, and she was dying to play the role of Marcia, but she couldn't get the funding either. But as soon as we got the money, I brought her in, and eventually she got the role.
Yeah, Tiffany's like one of the big scream queens of the 21st century, and you've worked with her on a few films.
Yeah, we bought it immediately, and I guess she was sort of my muse for a little while, because I was writing characters like her. I'd done a movie called Tomorrow by Midnight, and she would have been that role if I had known her by then, but, you know, and the funny thing is, we both grew up in New York. She was New Jersey, and in New Rochelle, and I was in Scarsdale, which was nearby, and she worked for Troma years later. You know, there's an age difference between us, but I never met her in New York until we both had moved out to California, and then when I ran into her, I immediately liked her personality, and she's so much fun, and loves doing horror films that we worked a little bit, and then finally we were able to really work on The Hazing, and then continued, you know, 7 or 8 films later. she's been great.
Yeah, I'm a huge fan. I've met her a few times. She's a great gal. I wanted to ask, too, the last thing about The Hazing. It features as the deranged professor antagonist Brad Dourif, who a lot of people will know from the Child's Play films as the voice of Chucky, the killer doll. How did he become involved in the project?
That was through a casting director. We went through 2 different casting people, and they had a connection to his manager, and they submitted him the script, and he liked it, and the money was okay, so he said yes. I was amazed because we literally got him in between finishing Lord of the Rings and just before he started Deadwood, which is why he had the mustache, and also why he did the British accent, because he had been perfecting that when he did Lord of the Rings. So he said, could he be British? I said, sure. So he did a great job. I loved him from One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest, and of course Exorcist 3, where he's brilliant, and his whole career, Chucky 2, of course. And I'd worked, which was funny, years earlier with Alex Vincent, when he was like 11 years old, after he'd done the first 2 Child's Play movies, a little kid. So I sort of made the rounds through the Child's Play actors, I guess. But he was great. He was like a collaborator on the movie. He came up with a lot of good ideas, and he also was really nice and willing to work both with Tiffany and with the other Andrew, who plays Doug, who gets possessed by him, to help with the voice. So he did all their lines in the British accent, so they could repeat and get the diction right, and they had to learn it like in 2 weeks, whereas he had, you know, months and years to kind of perfect it. But they did a good job, and that is their voices doing it, only we pitched it a little lower to make it a little bit more demonic, but that was them doing his accents properly. But Hazing was a fun movie, and I'm hoping one day it hits Blu-ray and gets a better audience, because it's a perfect Halloween film, and that's one of the few that every time people discover it, they really enjoy it. And I say it's kind of a nice companion piece too. There's Nothing Out There, whereas in There's Nothing Out There, I was making fun of the characters and the cliches. I was making fun of the cliches and of the situations in horror films. And then this one, I decided to make fun of the characters and have like the Breakfast Club of horror, where you had everyone who's a, you know, the jock and the blonde bimbo and the computer geek and all your cliches. And then once everything goes down and people start getting killed, everyone drops the facades and becomes real people, so you don't know who's going to live and die. That's really why I wanted to make the movie, because I thought I'd never seen, you know, the blonde bimbo suddenly turn into the resourceful girl, and that's just an act because guys like that sort of thing. Even with Scream, which had been done by the time we made the film, Rose McGowan was still playing the blonde bimbo, so I was trying to break other conventions that I hadn't seen addressed yet, so...
Well, I think that's a good place to get into your latest film that just came out, I think a month or so ago, Party Bus to Hell. I don't really know how to describe the film. How would you sum it up?
Party Bus to Hell is, it's coming out as Bus Party to Hell. The title was changed due to VOD. People do not like to scan past the letter B, I guess. They start at A or the numbers, and they go to B. So they flipped Party Bus to Bus Party. It actually comes out officially on DVD and Blu-ray on Tuesday, this coming Tuesday, June 12th, and then it hits Redbox a week after that, so it's going to be a much more available than it is now. It's just VOD. This movie was, I met these producers in Vegas, Sonny and Michael Mahal, and they contacted me about writing a teen comedy for them. They wanted to do it like a college comedy, and they had seen my pretty cool movies and sort of paid me a little bit of money to write that. And then after that, they said they wanted to do a horror film, and they had this idea of a party bus driving that breaks down the desert, and people get attacked by this cult out in the desert. So they wanted like kind of a Hills Have Eyes meets Hostel kind of movie. And I wasn't really interested in Hostel. As soon as they told me the idea of the bus breaking down the desert, I went immediately to the 1970s movie Race with the Devil, which I love, with Peter Fonda and Warren Oates and Loretta Swit. And I said, oh, okay, so basically this is like Race with the Devil, but without the race. And they didn't know the movie, but they were fine with that. So I kind of agreed to do it, and as I wrote it, I changed the title. Their original title was Party Bus Massacre, and while I was finished, I wrote something that I considered should be called Party Bus to Hell, because it was more along that line, and there was definitely more of a, I'd say, a fun trauma, you know, Ash versus Evil Dead sensibility to the movie, like anything goes, with a lot of humor. And, you know, they wanted lots of boobs and blood and beasts, and I gave them all that in spades. And once they read the script, they did love it. They had no idea how to make it, so they wanted me to direct it, and finally I wound up directing the movie as well. And it was 11 days of pretty much hell, shooting in the deserts of Nevada in Vegas. but we somehow pulled this thing together, and I've been happily surprised that the reviews so far have been almost unanimously wonderful on the movie, that people really get this film. It's funny because a lot of the films with my sense of humor, even There's Nothing Out There, it took a while for people to catch on to it because they're expecting a straight horror film. Nightmare Man 2, the film I did in between, has a sense of humor to it, as it's hazing, and I guess people are expecting more of a straight horror film, so when it gets goofy or, you know, there's puns, they're like, this is just stupid. And then afterwards, they realize the film is actually intentionally funny, and they catch on to it. But this one, for the first time, people get it from the beginning, because I guess Tara Reid, Party Bus to Hell, it kind of says it all. If you go in expecting, you know, The Exorcist, you're going to be sorely mistaken. So people have finally embraced the cheese of this movie and are getting a kick out of it.
What's it like? What's it like having to work on these films on such a short shooting schedule? It's almost like Roger Corman having to do, you know, films in like 3 days and whatnot. You said Party Bus to Hell was like an 11 day shoot.
Yeah. Well, you know, it's a joy, of course. You know, you want to shoot a film in one day if you get, no, it's hell. You never have enough time. And I mean, even if you're doing big movies, you never have enough time and money. It's always, it comes down to the same thing. I've learned, the funny thing is my first film, There's Nothing Out There, first feature, was a 24-day shoot. And that was, like, tight, but, you know, I actually had shooting schedules. Since then, I've never had a schedule that long. So every film I did after that, because I moved to California, and then I started working with this producer, and the training ground was that on these late-night movies, and they were features, and they were shot on film, they were shooting 90-minute movies in 6 days. And it was me and two other directors working in rotation all summer. They did 14 films back-to-back. And it was Roger Corman owned the domestic rights, so it was in association with the Corman thing. So it was a real crash course on, okay, if it can be done, I guess I can do it. And the fastest I've shot a movie is 5 days, I think. These are not works of art necessarily, but I've had a lot of 10 to 12. The Hazing was 18 days, which was a little bit better. And this new one, Art of the Dead, was turned out to be 18 days, which, again, is just about right. You know, but you're always doing long hours and long days, and you know, I do the best I can, and shoot very quickly. I've worked my record, I think, was Nightmare Man, where with one camera we did 78 setups. In one day. It was a 16-hour day, finding the sun coming up, but we were able to pull that off. So that's what you have to do. You just have to really move fast and prepare. It's all about pre-production. I do shot lists galore and sometimes storyboards, and everything is just really worked out to a T, so you can do those that kind of coverage and just move.
Well, I wanted to ask, too, how Tara Reid became involved. She sort of had a career renaissance now with the Sharknado movies.
That was the producers, Michael Mahal. They got her manager. They reached out to her. She has a certain rate. They met the rate for the day, for a day of shooting. We actually shot 2 days with her on Party Bus. So even though she's billed as the lead, it's a little like the Drew Barrymore Scream thing. She was very nice, though. She was fun to work with. She's a really nice person. The desert was a little hot, and at the end of the movie, there's a blooper with her, which is very funny. And she you know, appreciated it too. She got it. When we screened the film in Vegas, I sat next to her, and she laughed, and she thought it was very funny. But yeah, they just contacted her, and then since they had good luck with Party Bus, they reached out to her again for Art of the Dead. So she's in Art of the Dead too, with a bigger role. She's interspersed throughout the movie in this one, playing a totally different role. But she's a very nice person, and you know, between Big Lebowski and Urban Legend and the American Pie movies and now the Sharknado stuff, yeah, her career is all over the place. But she's working more than she ever has, she said.
Well, the last thing I'll say about Party Bus is that my initial impression, I thought to myself after viewing the film, I said, this is like The Hills Have Eyes. If The Hills Have Eyes had been directed by Hunter S. Thompson on an acid trip, and I love that.
Okay. Yes, and one of my favorite lines is that line when they're watching the cannibal cult members, and he says, The hills have eyes, ears, noses, and throats. So I definitely wanted to nod my head towards that. There's many, many references in the movie, and it just you know, you it's fast, it moves, it's short, it moves quickly, and it's you know, my thing was when I did it, I was like a little bit like Speed, which I really like, was like you can't stop the movie. If you stop to think about it, it all falls apart. It just has to keep going until the end, and then you realize it was just a trip. It was just like a roller coaster that you had no time to think about how silly the whole thing was, and just hopefully go along for the ride and have a good time, and drink some beers and take drugs or whatever you want to do. You'll appreciate it more probably. So the Hunter S. Thompson reference is very apropos.
Well, let's get into your two upcoming films. First, you have The Sunset Society, which has a big name, late rock star who just passed away a while back. Could you tell us about that film?
Yeah, that's an interesting little weird thing. Yeah, it's coming out. It's opening up downtown L.A. on July 6th, and then it hits DVD Blu-ray on July 24th. Cleopatra Films, part of Cleopatra Records, which produced my movie The Black Room, which is out on Netflix, the one I did before Party Bus with Natasha Henstridge and Lynn Shay from Insidious and Tiffany Shepis and Dominic Swain, James Duval, good cast. I'm proud of that movie too. They actually contacted me after we had finished Black Room about this movie that they just got the rights to called Sunset Society. An actress and filmmaker, first film, Phoebe Dollar, who's done a bunch of genre stuff, had directed this movie about 10 years ago. Now it's longer. And they finished the movie, but it was shot, you know, it was such a long time ago that the quality of the film wasn't great. And Cleopatra liked the soundtrack, and Lemmy, and there's Guns N' Roses, and you know, there's a lot of musicians in the movie because she had connections with all these people. They wanted to release the movie, but they felt they needed to update it slightly. So they wanted me to basically write and direct a new opening and ending to the film so they could turn the film into a film within a film. So I watched the film a few times and then came up with a way to make sense out of that and restructure the movie. So it was similar to actually the second film I ever did was a movie called My Family Treasure, which was a family film with Dee Wallace. After I did There's Nothing Out There, which was a film that was shot but unfinished, And I was brought in to shoot new footage and kind of do the wraparound. I shot about a half hour of the movie, and that's about what I did on this movie, too, was about a half hour is mine and the rest is Phoebe's. But I tried to stylistically capture the same flavor she was doing, because it really is her movie. And we shot it. I had about 2.5 days to shoot the footage that we shot. I brought Robert Donovan in, who's been in almost all my movies, and Ron Jeremy came back for a cameo, and Phoebe is stars in the movie as well as directed the movie, so she came back too. But I never worked with Lemmy. That was in the original footage because he had been dead for a couple of years by the time I got involved in this thing, or all the musicians. So it's going to be a very interesting response on how this movie comes across. I am very intrigued about in the opening 15 minutes of the movie, there is a vampire sort of sexual encounter attack scene with a girl that I've never seen done before. And I felt when I saw the original cut of the film that the film needed some more sex and violence, a little more. It needed something to stand out because a lot of vampires biting people with a little bit of blood, but it was a very low budget movie. So I came up with what I think is a very original and very gruesome kill sequence that I've never seen done. And, you know, I see True Blood and all these other things, but I've never seen them do this in a movie before. So I'm really looking forward to seeing it on the big screen with an audience and see how they respond to that. If they like that 5 minutes, I'll be very happy.
Well, I recommend Metalheads to see it just for Lemmy and because I love your films. Let's get into, you just finished wrapping on your next film, Art of the Dead. What is Art of the Dead about?
Okay, so Art of the Dead, it's about an art collector who buys a series of paintings at an art auction, benefit art auction. They're all animal paintings. There's seven of them. They're really cool. There's a peacock, a snail, toads, goat, lion, snake. Turns out, and he takes them home. He has a family. He has two little children. He has his second wife. His college son is visiting from college with his new girlfriend, and he has a teenage daughter. So he gives the paintings to everyone in the house. So they put up the paintings in different rooms, in different people's bedrooms, and you know, kitchen and office and stuff. And it turns out that the seven paintings actually represent the seven deadly sins. And each sin starts to affect the different members of the family. So the peacock is pride, the goat is lust, envy is a snake, the toads are greed, the pig is gluttony, the snails are sloth, and the lion is wrath. And all these paintings were painted by an artist named Dorian Wilde. You get the literary reference there, in 1890, who made a deal to make these paintings made on a very special kind of canvas and then he disappeared, and basically his soul is sort of inside the paintings and starts to affect everyone, and bad things happen to the family, and it's a very kind of surreal fever dream horror movie. There's definitely a bit of an Argento flavor to the visualization of the movie and the whole going into the paintings and things come out of the paintings. I'm very excited about it because I think it's a really cool, unusual horror story premise that's got some nasty things in it, but also done in a very surreal, kind of classy way. I'm hoping that this sort of has a bigger, broader audience. So it's totally different from Bus Party to Hell in terms of the flavor. So anyone expecting Bus Party to Hell 2, they'll have to wait till Bus Party to Hell 2. But this one, I think it can be good. And I'm very happy with the cast. Again, besides Tara Reid, we have Richard Grieco in the movie, who was great to work with and does a wonderful scene job in the movie. And Lucas Hassel, who was also my lead in Black Room, Alex Reinhardt, who was in there, Robert Donovan was in there, and a bunch of new actors that I hadn't worked with before, both from L.A. and Vegas. Beautifully shot by Michael Hsu, the same DP I worked with on Party Bus. I think it's going to be an interesting movie. We just wrapped, so now we've got about 5 months of post-production. We're hoping to get this thing ready for November for the American film market, and then you see where we go. We're crossing our fingers that this can get a bigger, wider release. You know, it's something that possibly a Blumhouse could be interested in if it turns out the way I see it in my head.
You've also got Jessica Morris is in it, who was in the Universal movie Role Models, which people are fans of.
Yes, Jessica Morris. Yeah, I left out. Yeah, Jessica. Well, Jessica is funny because I've never directed Jessica before, but I wrote three movies that she was in. She had written another very low budget but fun horror comedy called Sorority Slaughterhouse, and a family film called Timber the Treasure Dog that she was in, and Devilish Charm, another sort of evil charm bracelet movie. So I met her a few times, but we had never worked together, and I really wanted her in this one, and she auditioned. She was great, and she did a wonderful job. She works all the time. She's done a lot of Lifetime movies as well as that Universal one, but a lot of genre stuff for Dave Dakota and Charlie Band. She's been in some of the Evil Bong movies and stuff. So, but she's a very talented actress, and you know, she really gives quite a performance in this movie. I think people will remember it, especially her encounter with the goat creature.
So Art of the Dead, I get the impression it's going to be less of a comedy, more of like a surreal, almost Italian horror vibe to it.
Yes, definitely. Yes, there's a sense of fun to it, absolutely. But there's more plot and more meat to chew on in this one, and it deals with, you know, that's why What's Your Sin and the Seven Sins and the whole flavor of, you know, I try to come up with an unusual story that I haven't really seen. To me, it's my homage to the TV series The Night Gallery, the Rod Serling show in the early 70s after he had finished Twilight Zone. I'm a huge fan of Night Gallery, and the producers, again, had the concept idea was about the paintings that sort of start to kill the family, a family, and I came up with the idea of the Seven Deadly Sins and went back and started rewatching all the Night Galleries and trying to add that flavor and that surreal quality. And I'm also proud that there will be some post effects, but we did a lot of stuff in camera. We really went out of our way to come up with different lenses and distortions and all these interesting ways to convey the POVs of the paintings and people getting sucked into paintings and things like that that were done live. The end of the movie, there's a bit where we do go into the actual paintings, and everyone thought I was going to do it like green screen, you know, CGI, you know, Sin City style, but I was like, no, I want to do it in real locations. So it was a really cool process where we found a ranch 3 hours from Vegas. They took pictures of the ranch. We gave it to the artist who was drawing all of our paintings so he could incorporate the landscapes into his paintings, and then we recreated the paintings on the actual landscape. So we were shooting in the real locations with ponds and mud and fields and all that kind of stuff, which I think it adds such an organic feel to it all. It's really, really cool. And again, something I don't think people have really seen before. I rewatched the Stendhal Syndrome, Dario Argento's, you know, film there, and a few other movies for, you know, references and things.
Well, just two more questions. The first I have is, I believe Party Bus to Hell and Art of the Dead are two films. I don't know if they're your first films that you funded through like an Indiegogo type campaign, but what's it like doing that Indiegogo type fundraising?
Well, this was the producers again who started doing this. They did it with the one I wrote, The Last Day of School, the comedy. They've done an amazing job. I mean, they really know how to work the Indiegogo crowds and raise the money. I think they raised almost $140,000 on Art of the Dead, you know, in various campaigns. It's incredible. It's really cool. The only thing that I've had to deal with is the headache of that. One of the perks that people seem to love is if they give a certain amount of money, and it's not that much, it was like $1,000 or more, they can have a cameo role in the film. So both with Party Bus and Art of the Dead, I was constantly having to insert new little roles for people that, you know, that when you have a script is like a house of cards. You can only extend it so much. So when you're like, okay, we just have to add another 18 speaking parts in this movie, I'm like, excuse me? So I, you know, searching around trying to figure out who can play what and fill it up and work with the story and not just be totally like miscellaneous to the story. So that's been kind of a challenge. And they're very nice people, but again, not all of these Indiegogo backers are actors, and sometimes the performances are leave a little to be lacking. So, you know, they don't, not all the lines make the final cut, of course, but that's the new challenge that I've never had to deal with before. But I understand, like, well, you know, you got to get the money somehow. And Party Bus is still a low budget movie, although it is a bigger budget than Party Bus. I mean, Art of the Dead is still bigger than Party Bus, but it's still low budget, you know. Be nice to get a little more money, you know, if I get back to the, you know, $1 million range would be awesome at some point.
Well, I sort of like the low budget style. Gives your films a sort of full moon trauma feel.
Yeah, the look can still be professional. It's just a matter of having the time to do it, you know, properly. And you know, I mean, my movies look like they cost more than they do usually, and people don't guess how cheap they are. But you can only make a certain amount of money go a certain way. You know, I've always said I can make, you know, a $200,000 to $300,000 film look like a $2 to $3 million movie, but I can't make it look like a $10 million film. So if you're trying to get to that level of like, well, could it be a Blumhouse thing? Could it be in that ballpark? You have to kind of, you need more like $2 to $3 million to get up there, you know, which is what they spend on a lot of their films. But you can still have the energy and the fun of a thing. You just do it better, you know, with more effects, you know, and cooler, you know, cooler actors, you know, some more names in there. But you never have to lose the fun, low budget grindhouse feel to your films, I don't think.
So that leads me into the big question I have, because I want to leave our listeners on a really good note. What would your advice to aspiring and young filmmakers be? That may not, yeah, it can be difficult advice sometimes, I guess. So maybe it'll be a bad note. I don't know.
Well, I try to be more optimistic than pessimistic. I mean, I've been doing this professionally for almost 30 years now. Is that right? Yeah, about almost. So my advice has always been, no matter what you're doing, if you're a writer or a director or whatever it is, and you're starting a project, if it might be an independent thing you're doing for yourself or whatever, always finish what you start. If it's a screenplay or whatever, you know, just finish it. Get to the end of it, because so many people are interested, but they kind of, you know, toil, you know, they play around with it, and they get frustrated. You know, I can't tell you how many writers write 15, 20 pages and then rewrite those 15 and 20 pages until doomsday and never finish the script. So, you know, at some point you'll always not be happy with what you're doing, but just get through the end, because by the end you'll realize it's not as bad as you thought it was, and you'll have a finished product. Because if you're looking for anyone to give you money, they need to know you're responsible and that you're going to take them to the finish line. So it's really good practice to just finish what you start, and not let the naysayers or your own, you know, inner voice of you know, can I really, am I good enough, you know, just stopping you. There was a line I always remembered, which is from some independent movie that said, it's probably something else, but they said the thing about always having potential is as long as you never do anything, you always still have it. And I think that is the fear that a lot of people have that stops them from going after their goal or reaching for that finish line, because they just are so afraid they're not going to be good enough or be able to do it. So the thing is, it's you know, the more you do, the better you get. And, you know, back in the days of the beginning of, you know, Alfred Hitchcock's first movie was not Psycho, people made movies and they got better as they went along. Now it's everyone's so like, if the first one is not that breakout success hit, you know, my career's over. And it doesn't, you don't have to think that way, because, you know, it is, you know, you just, you know, Ed Wood, I always go back to Tim Burton's Ed Wood, you know, what'd you think of my movie? Worst thing you ever saw. Well, I hope you like the next one better. You know, I mean, that's a great, trade to have, and be an optimistic, you know, person, because this whole business is crazy. And, you know, if anyone logically thought before starting a movie about how hard it is to make a movie, they would never do it. And nobody would ever make a movie, because they'd be like, this is impossible. What are we doing? So it's this blind optimism that you need to have to succeed in this business and just force yourself to go forward. So that's the best thing I could say.
Well, would you, since we're wrapping up here, would you like to give out your website, how people can find out more about your films, any stuff for Art of the Dead?
Sure, yeah. Well, I'm on Facebook, so I'm pretty easy to be contacted there if you find my name there. I do have a website called rolfkanefsky.com. I'm on IMDb too, so again, I've always been pretty open to filmmakers and to people asking advice. I wrote an article years ago when the Nightmare Man, we got into the 8 films to die for, and it was on the Fangoria website about distribution, heaven and hell, because everyone always talks about the producing of the movie, but no one talks about the actual selling of the movie, which is a whole other, you know, ball of wax and a nightmare unto itself. So I wrote a whole article about that because, you know, when you make an independent film, you know, okay, that's great, but now how do you get it seen by the public? And that's getting harder and harder to do nowadays. So it's good to talk to other filmmakers and discuss, like, if you're going to go with a company, find out what other films they've released and then call up those filmmakers to ask them, how were you handled, treated by this company? Did they pay you? Did they rip you off? Did you never hear from them again after they signed the contract? I mean, this happens all the time. And, so that's, that's good stuff to talk about and know. So you'd reach me there, talk about stuff too. The other thing I'll just throw out there is film festivals. Don't take them as life and death. There are 9,000 film festivals now or more. And there's only a few big ones that matter, and the chances are that if you're independent and don't have a connection, they never even watch your film. They'll take your money, they'll take your film, but they won't even watch it. So if you get rejected from, like, the big festivals, it's like, oh, I'm not good enough, they hated my movie, it must suck. No, they probably didn't even watch the film. So I've got a whole thing about that, too, where, so you don't let those the rejection letters dissuade you from your passion.
Well, thank you for joining me on Parallax Views, Rolf Kanefsky.
Thanks for having me. It was great talking to you.
Well, that does it for this edition of Parallax Views. I hope you enjoyed my interview with Rolf Kanefsky. Gonna close out the show this time with a track called Boogeyman by The Zombie Dandies. We'll be right back.